worth its leaves, its blossoms. So, Brother Baker, I'm sure will have a blessing for us in the Lord's Word. We'll make it.
Certainly happy to be here once again. I think it's been 8 or 10 years since I was last in New Albany. Been about 45 years since I last spoke across the river here in Kentucky. As announced, the subject for tonight is one that should be of thrilling interest to all Bible students, even to all readers of the Bible, even to any and all who are at all acquainted with contemporary history, particularly as it has to do with the children of Israel, commonly known as the Jews. To Bible students, the scriptural presentation is familiar, that there are two Israels mentioned in the Bible. There's the fleshly house of Israel and the spiritual house of Israel. There are two Zions mentioned in the scriptures. There's an earthly Zion and a heavenly Zion. There are two Jerusalems that are brought to our attention. There's the earthly Jerusalem, and there is a heavenly Jerusalem. It is the earthly aspect of this problem that we want to consider tonight. And the way of introduction, I call your attention to passages of Scripture that many Bible students perhaps are not too familiar. And this is found in Deuteronomy 32 and 8. These are the words of Moses. Moses, who led the children of Israel out of Egyptian bondage unto Mount Sinai, where they entered into a covenant with the Lord, called the Law Covenant. Moses, who led them for the 40 years to the wilderness, to the brook Arnon, which they crossed in the fall of the year 1576 B.C. and entered the promised land east of Jordan. Moses, who led them as far as Jericho. Jericho was on the west bank of the Jordan. He led them to the east bank opposite Jericho. It was at that point the Lord, you remember, told him that his ministry was finished, his work was accomplished, and instructed him at the age of 120 years to go up into Mount Nebo, and from Pisgah's height he could look across the Jordan. They tell me that on a clear day it is possible from that altitude to see the whole of the west of part of Canaan as far as the Mediterranean Sea. From that height, Moses was given a glimpse of the territory, and he died. And we read of him in the day of his death that his eye was not dimmed, nor his natural vigor unabated. The Lord buried him. Byron, the poet, wrote a very interesting poem on this, and one or two of the lines read, "It was the grandest funeral that ever took place on earth, for the angels of God upturned the sod and buried Moses there." And the scripture adds, "No one knoweth his sepulcher unto this day." Must have been a marvelous obsequy when the angels themselves were the pallbearers in the interment of Moses. These are the words of Moses in the 32nd chapter of Deuteronomy and the 8th verse. Moses here is and these last two chapters is summing up the work which the Lord accomplished through his ministry toward the children of Israel. And these words read, "When the Most High gave to the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the bounds of the people according to the number of the children of Israel." Notice these words. "When the Most High gave to the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the bounds of the people, all these people, the sons of Adam, according to the number of the children of Israel." This is a very important fact. It is the key to much, not only of scriptural history, but of secular history as well. Now, this incident happened after the deluge. There were no nations prior to the deluge. We read that all mankind were of one speech and one language. You know, national distinctions are based in our day and for centuries past not only upon racial differences but of language differences. This is interesting because the Lord, through the prophet, tells us that when the kingdom of Christ is set up on earth, when the Lord answers the prayers of his people uttered in the past 19 centuries, "Thy kingdom come," that he will turn unto the people a pure language. And once again, all mankind will be of one speech and of one language. So these language differences occurred after the deluge, and the Bible gives us the account. Remember, it says that at the building of the Tower of Babel, that the Lord confounded their speech. As a result, they were scattered over the earth. But there was a definite program in carrying this out, a program arranged by the Lord and carried out through his providences toward the children of man. Now, this incident happened long before there was an Israelite. It happened before Abraham there. And we think we have the clue to that in Genesis 10:25, where we read, "And unto Eber were born two sons, the name of the one Peleg, for in his days was the earth divided." Now, this doesn't refer to the geological earth. It refers to the geographical earth. And history bears ample testimony to this fact. Something did occur some 4,000 years ago, nearly, that led to the dispersion of the children of Adam and their various families to different portions of the eastern hemisphere. Now, the word Peleg means divided. Notice the margin in your King James Version. Now, Peleg was born 101 years after the flood. He lived for 239 years. Therefore, the year of his death was the 340th year after the flood. Men had begun to multiply upon the earth considerably by that time, according to the scriptures. It's interesting to note this chronological situation. You know, Noah lived for 350 years after the flood. When he died, he was 950 years old. He belonged to the antediluvian period, when the lifetime of men ran up into the hundreds of years. He was 600 years old when he entered the ark and the flood came. So Noah was alive when Peleg died. He lived for 10 years longer than that period of time. Not only was he alive, but the three sons of Noah were alive. Ham, Shem, and Japheth. Not only they, but their sons, their grandsons, and their great-grandsons, and maybe their greater-grandsons, were all alive 340 years after the flood. Shem was alive, we know, for he lived for 500 years after the flood. He was 600 years old when he died. Terah, the father of Abraham, was about 70 years old in the 340th year after the flood. So there's a close tie in all this matter. You know, Terah lived for 205 years. He was a father of Abraham and of two other sons, according to the scriptural account. Now I want to emphasize or call your attention to the close family relationship in this connection back there. Remember, Adam lived for 930 years. Methuselah, the oldest one of the patriarchs before the flood, lived for 969 years. Now, the total of the ages of Adam and Methuselah were very close to some 18 or 1900 years. The total period from the creation to the flood, according to the Bible, and as plainly stated in those opening chapters of Genesis, was 1656 years. So Adam's lifetime lapped over into the lifetime of Methuselah, nearly 250 years. In fact, in Noah's day, when Noah was born, and for several centuries later, all of the patriarchs before the flood, except Adam and Enoch, were alive. So they must have known Noah, and Noah must have known them. Methuselah knew Adam, Methuselah knew Noah. And he knew Noah for the 600 years of Noah's life before the flood. For Methuselah died the year of the flood. Not in the flood, but the year of the flood. Thank you. By the way, I forgot to give you the Christian love and greetings of my own home class in Portland, Oregon. I left there on July 11th. Since then, I've traveled more than 4,000 miles. And since the first of the year, I've traveled over 10,000 miles, visiting the brethren south, west, east, and now through the central state. So, I bring you their Christian love. Yes, Methuselah knew Noah. We had an interesting experience in Portland. We have a brother, one of our elders there. He's retired now. But for some years, he was an engineer with a telephone company. In fact, a very prominent engineer. He was one of those who helped to develop the multitude or the multiple transmission of conversations over a single wire. Well, some years ago, Mr. Ripley came out with an item. You remember Ripley, and believe it or not. And in this particular item, he showed a man swimming in the ocean with Jewish features and long beard. The caption was, "The man who swam 9 months." Now, Ripley had an offer of $100 to anybody who could prove a single statement that he made to be incorrect. This brother challenged that statement. "A man swimming 9 months." And he wrote to Ripley called his attention to his mistake and why he was mistaken. Within a month, he got a letter back from Ripley with a $100 check, and with the information that before making that statement, he had consulted the leading authorities in the Catholic, Protestant, and Jewish faith. But since he had received this brother's letter, he had investigated it for himself and found out they were all mistaken. And they were. Not only on this, but on many other scriptural subjects. So, Methuselah didn't have to swim for 9 months. The secret was in the very language of the Bible. Remember, it says, and Adam lived 130 years, and he begat Seth. And all of the characters that are mentioned live so long, and they begat. And there's a difference between begetting and birth. And Mr. Ripley and these ministers had failed to take that into consideration. So while Methuselah died the year of the flood, he didn't die in the flood. You remember Noah built an ark on the instruction of the Lord. The dimensions of that ark are given in the Genesis account. And according to marine architects, it is built on the most successful and useful lines for cargo carrying capacity. And it was the largest cargo carrying barge or boat that man has ever built. Marine architects admit it. It must have been a tremendous job. You know, we often think that just Noah was busy building that ark. Oh, maybe the three sons helped him out. But he must have had considerable of a crew working for him for some time, even though it was 120 years in building, or thereabouts. It was a great engineering task, particularly for that day. It would be a tremendous task for engineers even today. And yet it was built. So it's quite possible that Noah had the advice of Methuselah and others. You know, mankind in those days were far more intelligent than what they are today. You know, we have a theory in this world that back about Noah's time, they could neither read nor write. They were just about one jump removed from the ape. The fact of the matter is, physiologically, psychologically, or any other logically, mankind are nearer to the ape today than they have ever been in the past. This theory of evolution has no foundation or basis in fact, and the evidence that some scientists seek to produce would not stand up in any court if they had to prove it in any court. The Bible account is far more reasonable. So Noah was 600 years old when he entered the ark. Shem was 100 years old when he entered the ark. Shem must have known Methuselah. Maybe as a babe, Methuselah carried him around in his arms. You know, things haven't changed too much over the centuries. The French have an adage to this effect: the more things change, the more they remain the same. And when you stop to think about it, it's largely true. Old people change their garb, change their customs somewhat, but family relations and things of that kind, largely the same, down through the centuries. As we said, Shem lived for 500 years after the flood. You know, Abraham was 138 years old when Shem died. Isaac was 38 years old when Shem died. Notice the connection. Adam, Methuselah, Shem, Abraham. It wasn't a matter of a tradition. This was a family matter. Close family relationship from Adam down to Abraham. And the information recorded in the scriptures was by those who were personally acquainted with the facts that they record. You know, the book of Genesis, one of the five books that are accredited to Moses, and yet you won't find Moses' name mentioned in Genesis. You mentioned in the other four books many times. Moses was the editor of this book. He compiled it. He compiled it from earlier family records and the internal evidence supports such a thought. What I'm trying to get over to you is that this isn't a question of tradition or mythology. These are actual facts by those who knew the matter personally in their family connections. Now, this incident to which Moses refers in the first text that we call to your attention happened sometime in that 340 years when Noah was alive, and when all of the 10 patriarchs after the flood, from Shem to Terah, were also alive, and when the children and grandchildren of Ham and Japheth were also alive. So there must have been a conference of some kind to determine the disposition geographically of the descendants of Noah. You remember they had a commission to multiply and refill the earth. So provision had to be made to take care of the families as they would increase from families into tribes and from tribes into nations. In this 10th chapter of Genesis, there are 70 families mentioned by name. And out of these 70 families came the present inhabitants of the earth. There were 30 families out of Ham. There were 26 families out of Shem. 14 families out of Japheth. Now, to abbreviate the matter, we simply state that in this conference, whenever it occurred, or however it occurred, Europe, as far as the Ural Mountains, was given unto the descendants of Japheth. Asia was given unto the descendants of Shem, and Africa was given unto the descendants of Ham. That was divinely arranged according to their families. It took some centuries to bring about this distribution. There were some lapse and marginal territory, but gradually in the providence of the God, mankind was thus in their diversity scattered over the eastern hemisphere. It's quite evident to many and to all historians and scholars that the descendants of Ham predominate in Africa. And you know, something's happening in Africa today. God gave Africa to the descendants of Ham and the 30 different families. They were not all colored by any means. The Egyptians, now represented by about 3 or 4 million Copts, dominated in practical peonage and slavery to the Arabs, who are Semitic and not Semitic. Today, looks like the descendants of Ham are going to drive the white man out of Africa. Maybe after all, the original purposes of the Lord will be fully carried out. The white man has gone many places where he doesn't belong. Some of the descendants of Shem, like the Arabs, have gone places where they don't belong. They have no more right in Africa than the white man has. So there's these readjustments going on all over the earth. They're deeply rooted in the history of the past. So before ever there was an Israelite, all these arrangements were made. And subsequently, and history bears ample testimony to this, there is historical evidence today, uncovered by the spade of the archaeologists, pointing back to the very facts that we've just mentioned. But that's another story in itself. You remember while Abraham, who was the father of the children of Israel according to the flesh, was an Ur of the Chaldeans, when the Lord God is said to have appeared unto him and told him that if he would go to a land that he would show him, he would there make of him a great nation, that he would bless him, and he would be a blessing, and they that blessed him the Lord would bless, and they that cursed or opposed him the Lord would curse or oppose. So Abraham left Ur of the Chaldeans. There's considerable detail, we won't take time to go into it. And accompanied by Terah, his father. You know, Terah, apparently, according to the Bible account, had gone into politics. And politics makes strange bedfellows. So, for a time, apparently, he was the mayor or governor of Ur of the Chaldeans and the adjacent territory. You know, when the Bible speaks of cities back there, don't get the idea that there were cities like Louisville, Kentucky, or New Albany. They were little villages, sometimes walled villages to protect themselves from wild beasts, as well as from wilder, marauding men. And when we read of a king back there in Abraham's day, we mustn't think of a person like the King of England, others of the rulers of my boyhood days. We would call them mayors, or maybe just a councilman today. You remember when five kings of their armies came down and took Sodom, and Lot, who was dwelling there, took the Sodomites prisoners and plundered the cities or the villages of the plain. Abraham heard of it. And according to the Bible account, he armed 318 of his servants. And he took after these five kings and their armies. And he pursued them for about 100 miles when he caught up with them. And he smote them hip and thigh. Now the names of these kings are given. And the archaeologists have uncovered the record of one of them, the prominent one, that's mentioned in the account. So that apparently those great armies back there were just groups of marauding men, and their leaders were called kings. And King Abraham, with 318 of his servants, thrashed those five armies, recovered Lot and the other prisoners, and all the spoil and plunder that they had taken. That was some time after Abraham left Ur for the Chaldeans. So accompanied by his father Terah, he left Ur and started on an 1,100-mile journey from Ur of the Chaldeans to Canaan. He went westward and northward to a place called Haran. There Terah took Seth. And they stayed there 5 years until Terah died. Now, Haran is the name of Abraham's oldest brother. And that particular village was evidently named after his brother, and his brother evidently lived there with his family and his growing tribe. So when Terah died, Abraham resumed his journey. There he met his nephew Lot, the oldest son of Haran. And evidently they were about the same age. And they became quite companionable. So when Abraham resumed his journey, Lot decided to accompany him, and he did. Another 500 miles, nearly, to Canaan. He left Haran in the fall of the year 2046 B.C. And he arrived at the borders of Canaan and crossed over in the spring of B.C. 2045. How do we know it was the spring? Well, 430 years later, we are told, when Moses led the children of Israel out of Egypt, that event occurred after 430 years, even to the self-same day, after Abraham had entered Canaan. Moses led the children of Israel out of Egypt. You know, God is an exact timekeeper. Some Bible students don't believe that anymore. But it's true, just the same. The apostle tells us in Ephesians, the first chapter, 10th verse, that God is doing all things, that is, working out his plan, according to the counsel of his own will. They tell me the Greek has the thought of the secret counsel of his own will. In other words, God hasn't asked anybody's advice. He doesn't need to ask anybody's advice. Not even of the angels in heaven, and certainly no one on earth. He has an exact schedule. And his plan is working out according to that schedule. And I wouldn't be surprised if some good people working on the wrong schedule will find themselves on the wrong corner when the bus goes by. It has happened at times, of course. So when Abraham entered Canaan, the Lord appeared unto him. And we read of this in Genesis 13:15. Remember, the Lord told Abraham, lift up your eyes and look eastward, westward, northward, southward. All the land that thou seest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed after thee. You'll find this account also in Genesis 12:1, and also the 7th verse. In fact, this covenant which God confirmed, according to Paul in the Galatian epistle, when Abraham entered Canaan, is repeated 8 times unto Abraham. And these repetitions are not new covenants. It's simply a restatement of the original one which was made with him when he entered Canaan, confirmed with him, and certain additional details are added. That's all. It was repeated twice unto Isaac. It was repeated twice unto Jacob, in all 12 times. This Abrahamic covenant is repeated. So, we read here in Genesis 13:15, these are the words of God to Abraham, for all the land that thou seest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed forever. Notice the emphasis on the land. Now, keep that in mind. You'll have occasion to refer to it, or the scriptures refer to it repeatedly. Through the prophets, time after time, the emphasis on the land, on the land. And remember, the Lord told the children of Israel centuries later, when they had become a nation, a great people, he said, I did not select you because you were the noblest people on earth. And he says, I'm not favoring you because you deserve it, but because I gave my word unto your fathers. God's honor of this day. And because he sware unto Abraham, unto Isaac, and unto Jacob, that their posterity would be his peculiar people, a holy nation dedicated unto him, he intended to keep his word, whether the descendants of Jacob really deserved it or not. And he is keeping his word after many centuries. In Ezekiel, the 20th chapter and the 6th verse, the prophet here reminds the children of Israel. Ezekiel was writing from up in the eastern end, or just beyond the eastern end of the region referred to in the Bible as Mesopotamia. You remember 120 years nearly before the overthrow of Zedekiah and Judah, the Assyrians had taken the 10 tribes prisoners, and they had transplanted them from Israel to that territory between the Euphrates and the Tigris River, about 300 or 350 miles from the Persian Gulf. And when Judah was taken prisoner, when Zedekiah was overthrown, the tribes of Judah and Benjamin were taken prisoners, Nebuchadnezzar transported these Israelites to the same place and planted them there among their own brethren that had been transplanted 120 years before. You know, there is a theory prevalent in this English-speaking world particularly, a theory of British Israel, that the English people are the descendants of the 10 lost tribes. There's no such thing as 10 lost tribes, historically or otherwise. The phrase doesn't occur in the Bible. The only place that phrase is found is in the Aramaic version. And there it is an interpolation. They never were lost. They're not lost yet. And the history of the Israelites is woven into the history of all peoples down through the centuries. So don't let anybody fool you with this British Israel delusion. I know where it originated. It originated in the city of Portland when I was a boy. Oh, there'd been some rumors about it earlier. But there was a man there by the name of J.H. Allen, Reverend J.H. Allen. He wrote a book, and the title of the book was Judah's Scepter and Israel's Birthright. He sent a copy of it to Queen Victoria. And remember, Queen Victoria had as her prime minister a Jew, Disraeli. It was Disraeli that made the British Empire. He was the one who arranged for Queen Victoria to be crowned Empress of India, and her sons to be crowned as Emperor of India, and thus the British Empire. It was created by a Jew. But when Queen Victoria read this book and found out that she was supposed to be a lineal descendant of David and was sitting in the throne of the Lord in the place of David, she swallowed it hook, line, and sinker and passed it over to the British Foreign Office, and it became a part of Britain's propaganda from that day to this. And the rulers of Britain are supposed to have been crowned on the Stone of Scone. There is a stone beneath the British throne, but Jacob never set his head on that stone. Probably some centuries ago, it was dug up at a British quarry. There may be a Scotch quarry because it came from Scotland. Be that as it may, British Israel theory is the delusion and the snare. So Ezekiel wrote, saying, or quoting the Lord, as having delivered the children of Israel out of Egypt, and this is a quote, into a land that I had espied for them. Now this word espied is an old English word, meaning selected. Into a land that I had selected for them. When was the selection made? Back there in that early period, during the first 340 years after the flood. In 1 Chronicles 16, 15 to 18, we have what are called the last words of David. And David says, the word which he commanded to 1,000 generations, that's a long time, which he made with Abraham, his oath unto Isaac, confirmed the same unto Jacob, for a law to Israel, an everlasting covenant, saying, unto thee will I give the land of Canaan, the lot of your inheritance. That lot was cast way back there in that first 340 years. Now, I want to consider a matter of chronology and dispute certain sections. And the prophecy concerning it is found in Leviticus, the 26th chapter. You're familiar with this. I presume that you are. The matter of the times of the Gentiles. These times of the Gentiles began in 606 B.C., ended in 1914 A.D. And we read, or rather I remind you of the fact that in this chapter the Lord told through Moses, because Moses is the author here, the children of Israel, that if they failed to keep that law covenant, if they were disobedient, if they went into idolatry, he would punish them. Punish them seven times. Now, a prophetic time is a period of 360 years. And seven of them is 2,520 years. So these times of the Gentiles, evidently, was the fulfillment of this prophecy. And we read in the 42nd verse, then, that is, at the end of these times of the Gentiles, then will I remember my covenant with Jacob, also my covenant with Isaac, also my covenant with Abraham will I remember, and I will remember the land. Notice the emphasis on the land. Now, this doesn't refer to spiritual Israel. They're not going to inherit any land. There's no land in heaven. I know anything about. It refers to fleshly Israel and the land that God promised unto them as an everlasting inheritance, in perpetuity as their possession. Then the 44th verse, yet while they will be in the land of their enemies, during these times of the Gentiles, I will not cast them away to destroy them utterly, and to break my covenant with them. Now, Paul quotes these words in the 11th chapter of Romans. Hath God utterly cast away his people? God forbid! Blindness in part has happened unto Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in, and then all Israel shall be saved, for this is my covenant with them. When I take away their sin, the covenant mentioned here in connection with the times of the Gentiles. So, God is interested in these people, his people. He's interested also in the Gentiles. And so Paul says, if the casting of them away be the riches of the Gentiles, because in rejecting them, the gospel message went unto the Gentiles, to Cornelius, the first of the Gentile converts. What will the receiving of them be after the receiving of cast off Israel back into divine favor be but life from the dead for both Jew and Gentile? That's his argument there. And when he speaks of the fullness of the Gentiles becoming, that English word fullness is from the Greek word pleroma. And look it up in Strong's Concordance, or in Liddell and Scott. Both of these authorities, recognized authorities, tell us that in that word pleroma, there is always a time element. Luke uses it, or quotes the Lord as using it, in the 17th chapter, where we read that Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in. Until the times of the Gentiles be complete. So there too the word pleroma, translated by the English word fullness, plainly indicates a period of time. And that time is the times of the Gentiles, 606 B.C. to 1914 A.D. Well, what happened in 1914? You know, in March 1914, I started out on a pilgrim trip, north through Washington, up into Canada. And when I got to a little town called Mount Vernon in northern Washington, there was a nice class there of brethren. One of the elders was a barber and a very diligent Bible student. And he came to me after a meeting and he said, "Brother Baker, the time of trouble will start on the 28th day of July this year." And I asked him why he thought that. Well, he said, "I've been checking up on the Jewish calendar. And according to the Bible account of the fall of Jerusalem, of the armies of Nebuchadnezzar, that they broke through the walls of the city on what corresponds to this year as the 28th day of July. Zedekiah and his family, together with his principal officers, fled through one of the gates. 4 days later, they were captured. 6 days, or 2 days after their capture, they were brought before Nebuchadnezzar. His sons were slain before him, and many of the nobles were put to death. And Zedekiah's eyes were put out. He was blinded." Right to the day. You know, Austria declared war on Serbia. Russia declared war on Austria. France, or Germany declared war on Russia. France declared war on Germany. And finally, England. All in 6 days declared war. And when the declaration of war was made by England, Lord Grey is said to have been standing in the British Foreign Office looking toward the continent of Europe. And he is quoted as having made the remark, "The lights have gone out over Christendom." And it was true. For that world war, international war, involving all of the governments within the old boundaries of the Roman Empire, the fourth empire of Daniel's vision, began then. This wasn't accidental. The times the Gentiles had ended. And remember, the Allies in their extremity, the Central Powers pressing ahead everywhere, and the fate of England and of France was in the balance. A Jew appeared on the scene. Weizmann, the most outstanding chemist in Europe. He had perfected an explosive. And whoever would obtain possession of that explosive might be the victor in that war. Lord Balfour was a prominent official. I forget just what his title was. But he was interested in the matter, naturally. And he went to Weissman and made him a proposition that if he would give the secret unto Britain, Britain would guarantee that when the war ended, the Jew would have his homeland back in Palestine. Known as the Balfour Declaration. Public declaration was made to that effect. From that hour, the Allies began to win. And to accomplish that victory, the United States was brought in to the war. And the Allies won that war. At least they won the battles. And, well, England was given a mandate over the territory of Palestine. But just about that time, oil was discovered on the Arabian Peninsula. Oil in vast quantities. And there was a wild scramble to corner that oil and to exploit it. England was afraid to have any Jew between her and the oil. Well, you could hardly blame her in a way, looking back to the history as to the Israelitish people through all the centuries in all the nations in which they were involved. You know, they're called Hebrews, after Heber, one of the 10 patriarchs after the flood. And the word Heber means colonizer. And wherever honor among any nation through the past 30 centuries, there was a dollar to be made, there was a Jew there to make it, an Israelite. And in our Lord's day, there were more Jews outside Palestine than there were in it. In fact, it is said that there were more Jews in Alexandria in Egypt than there was in Palestine in the Lord's day. And that's the reason why the question arose, according to the Gospels, that when Jesus said, "Get a little while and you'll see me no more," they began to ask, is he going unto the dispersion? So they thought that Jesus was going to quit Palestine and travel abroad among the Jews in other parts of the Roman Empire. So the Allies won, or thought they did, that first war. But England reneged, went back on the Balfour Agreement. England has never kept an agreement with any nation when her interests were at stake. And now she's double-crossing us in this present situation in respect to Russia. Keep your eye on her. Talk about Russians not keeping treaties. There are others, Gentile powers that have been just as guilty so far as history records the matter. And what happened to the British Empire? Look at it. Shrunk, shrunk, shrunk until it is indeed a tight little island. And it's going to be much tighter before the problems of the Lord had finished with her double-crossing of Israel. When she gave up the mandate and withdrew, she turned her arms over to the Arabs and said, "Here they are. Go ahead." And to the amazement and consternation of England and the other countries, the Arabs were lit as they had never been before. And then, as the Jews sought to take all the territory that had been promised her, the United Nations stepped in and cut it in half. This has happened later decades. You know, there were literal miracles happened in connection with that first campaign and this last one. It won't take time to go in. That time is slipping by. There's many interesting facts that we'd like to bring to your attention. Just want to read a couple of scriptures here. Bearing upon this, Psalms 102:13. Know these psalms are prophecies. Most of them have to do with the millennial age. Most of them are millennial age prophecies. The 119th psalm particularly is this true. And we read in this 102nd psalm, "Thou shalt arise and have mercy upon Zion." This is earthly Zion. "For the time to favor her, yea, the set time is come." God had the time for everything, an exact time. In Jeremiah 31, 35, 36, we read here from Rotherham's translation, "This is the word of the Eternal, who set the sun to light the day and the moon and the stars to light the night. This is the Eternal's word. Only when heaven above can be measured and the foundations of the earth be laid bare, will I ever cast off the race of Israel for all that they have done, saith the Eternal." Spite of all their backsliding, spite of all their idolatry, the Lord says he will never cast them off. And he hasn't. Ezekiel 36:22, "Therefore say unto the house of Israel, thus saith the Lord God, I do not this for your sake, O house of Israel, but for mine holy name's sake, which ye have profaned among the heathen whither ye went." There are literally scores and scores of scriptures stating the Lord's purpose in respect to fleshly Israel. We can't take time to go into these. Just want to call your attention to factor two in closing. 12 years ago, or rather, let's state it this way. Today, there are more than 2 million Jews or Israelites in Palestine. More, probably, than went out of Egypt under the leadership of Moses. There's a great question as to the number involved. You know, no Hebrew scholar to this day knows what the Hebrew word or sign translated thousands really means. There may be instances where it might mean a thousand. Sometimes it's translated tens. Sometimes it's translated thousands. Families. And so when it says 600,000 men capable of bearing arms followed Moses out of Egypt, you know, that was a long trip to Sinai. Take and measure it sometime on the map. And you know, they didn't have the means of transportation we have today. If there were 600,000 men bearing arms, accompanied by other men, young and old, the women folks, and the other slaves that fled with them, called the mixed multitude, and all their cattle and stock and possessions, you know, we haven't got the facilities today to transport in the time involved the number of people that are usually supposed to accompany Moses with all their goods. It's a problem in logistics, which engineers would dislike to have thrust upon them, even today. And there's been a lot of investigations made in recent years. So in all probability, the 2 million in Palestine today are more than went out of Egypt. You know, if there was 4 million that accompanied Moses, as some have estimated, that was more than the inhabitants of Egypt. The world was sparsely settled there. Think of Abraham 2 centuries before, wandering up and down with his flock, all over the land. And think of Moses of Israel through the desert region. It wasn't as desert as it is today at that time. But there was a few wandering Bedouins that challenged his approach. What I'm trying to impress upon you is that this thing that has happened in your lifetime and mine in Palestine is the greatest political miracle of 2,000 years. Israel is back in its own land. You know, sometimes it gives me a little concern. You remember what Isaiah says in the 66th chapter, before Zion travailed, she brought forth a man-child. After her travail, she'll bring forth her other children. Read the Lord's prophecy there. You know, in 1947, the House of Savoy fell in Italy. Brother Russell, in his explanation of that scarlet-colored beast with 7 heads and no horns, in the 17th chapter of Revelation, says the 7th head is the House of Savoy. That when the House of Savoy falls, Italy will plunge into anarchy, if not anarchy, will become a republic, which will lead into anarchy. At the end of this last war, which hasn't ended, the armies of the United States, American bayonets, American ships, and American money saved the papacy from the communists. The communists were prepared and could have taken over all of Italy, which would have meant the end of the papal system in Italy. But American bayonets and $2 billion of the taxpayers' money poured into Italy have preserved this thing called a republic in Italy, which is not a republic. And the strongest communist party outside of Russia is in Italy, prepared to take over at the most convenient time, which isn't far distant. Yes. Strange things are happening in this world with the end of the times of the Gentiles. Now, more than 40 years in the past. You know, the territory that Israel has, surrounded by enemies on every side, that's a family quarrel. The descendants of Esau and Ishmael are still fighting, quarreling with the descendants of Jacob, Israel, and you'll find the situation there today described in the 83rd Psalm in detail, and the very words that Nasser had been using are mentioned in that 83rd Psalm. It's startling. And then the Lord describes what's going to happen to Nasser and the rest of the Arabs when they undertake to put into action their plans and schemes. One more incident. 12 years ago, Beersheba, That's at the head of the Negev desert. The Negev is the territory over which Abraham wandered for many years. And it was a little Arab village of about 600, destitute and sick Arabs. A Jewish doctor went down there to see what could be done. You know what's happened in 12 years? Beersheba is a modern city of 45,000 people. Hospital, school, paved streets, all modern improvements in sanitation. And outside of it, improving the Negev desert, are 50,000 other Jews. These statistics are a year old. This month, we have them dedicated a plant for turning salt water into fresh water, just a short distance from Beersheba on the Mediterranean. And according to the accounts, the reports, and by the way, Fairbanks Moores Company, the largest manufacturer of pumps in the United States, constructed this plant. And they have a license from the Israelitish government to make use of the process elsewhere. And the state of California is trying to obtain the right to use the process. This token plant will have a capacity of 100,000 gallons of fresh water a day, produced at a cost estimated anywhere from 35 to 65 cents a thousand gallons. You can't buy water here at that price. In over 87 years down in the seventh millennium, things have happened in those 87 years. What has become of the great empires of earth? Turkish Empire, Chinese Empire, Japanese Empire, the Russian Empire, the German Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and the British Empire. They're gone, and they're gone forever. What has happened to the great kingdoms of earth? They're gone, and they're gone forever. Oh, there's a few petty kings still hanging around, opening bazaars and being present at the christening of babies. Something like that. You know, there is not a government in existence today existing in the form in which it existed when I was a boy. Not even these United States. We were a republic in my boyhood days. Today we are a democracy. And you know what that word means in the Greek? The rule of the mass. Literally the rule of the mob. And according to the Bible, democracy is the lowest form of government among fallen mankind. It's only one half step removed from anarchy. And today we're slipping over the brink into the chasm of anarchy. Anarchy in the disunited nation. Anarchy in our executive department of the government. Look what's happened in Cuba. Look what's happening in our relation to Russia and elsewhere. Anarchy in the judiciary. Look what's happening, what's happened there in recent years. And anarchy in Congress, factionalism and so on. And the spirit of anarchy is spreading and growing and increasing. Yes, the times of the Gentiles have ended. Their kings have had their day, and Israel is on the ascendancy. And as Israel rises, the star of hope for all mankind also shines the brighter. For the blessings of the Lord will come to the great Gentile world through restored Israel and through no other source. It's going to be a bitter pill for some Gentiles. But look at the bitter pills the Gentiles have doled out to Israel over the centuries. Well, Lord, have you blessed me.